This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you'd like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
And now, one of the papers given at this year's International Broadcasting Convention in Brighton. Performance and implementation of single sideband on a high-power broadcast transmitter by S.D. Pace and J.E. Brett from Marconi Communication Systems Limited in the UK. Following the resolution by the World Administrative Radio Conference in 1979, aimed at improving the utilisation of the HF broadcast bands, there has been much speculation regarding the possible introduction of a single sideband transmission system. Various studies, such as those by Groschel and the CCIR, have examined the necessary technical parameters for such a system, a provisional specification being adopted by the first session of the subsequent WARC held in 1984. One of the duties of the second session of this conference held in 1987 was to review certain aspects of this specification and agree the schedule for the eventual transition to single sideband. Other matters on its agenda included securing an agreement on a future planning procedure, the overall aim being to produce a list of recommendations for ultimate consideration by the ITU. However, the conflicting priorities of the states represented at this conference, complicated by the ever-increasing congestion in the HF bands, led to great difficulty in reaching any agreement on the important question of planning. Despite extending the conference, it was only possible to reach a compromise solution, effectively deferring a decision to a proposed future WARC, which has itself to be sanctioned by the ITU conference, scheduled for 1989. Although the conference did suggest further studies aimed at realising a more acceptable planning system, it must have been evident that the provision of additional channels has now become essential. Several proposals were therefore agreed with this objective in mind. For example, a future WARC is likely to consider further extending the HF bands allocated to broadcasting. Perhaps not surprisingly, given these circumstances, it was also decided to recommend that the transition to single sideband should begin immediately, with double sideband transmissions ceasing altogether by the year 2015. The implications of this decision are most significant. There is the risk that in prematurely switching to the proposed system, which has only been subject to limited trials, the overall situation will not be improved. Indeed, this concern was expressed when the scheme was first adopted in 1984. There is little doubt that if the conversion to single sideband could be accomplished overnight, then the well-known advantages of the system would be realised. Firstly, up to double the existing number of channels would be available in any given band. Secondly, coverage could be maintained with much lower radiated power. And thirdly, the synchronous detection process should provide improved performance under adverse propagation conditions. However, the enormous number of conventional receivers currently in service precludes any sudden changeover. This led to the present idea of a long transitional period, during which both the sideband and the carrier would be maintained at relatively high power. It has been argued that adequate compatibility with existing receivers would then be maintained, while the increasing number of dedicated single sideband sets would accept any of the modulation schemes. Nevertheless, it is still debatable whether this arrangement will prove entirely satisfactory. Some of the envisaged problems are now outlined. Receiver compatibility. The fundamental reason for having a long transitional phase is to maintain compatibility with existing receivers employing envelope detection. Yet it still seems questionable whether adequate compatibility can be guaranteed. It can be readily demonstrated that provided the carrier is retained at a high enough relative level, then a single sideband signal can be satisfactorily demodulated using envelope detection. This is because the envelope of the single sideband signal approximates more closely to that of its double sideband counterpart as the carrier level is increased. Previous attempts have been made to exploit this to enable a practical single sideband broadcast system to be more easily realised. In fact, as long ago as 1934, Marconi engineers investigating this possibility demonstrated that reception quality adequate for even domestic service broadcasting could be achieved, but only if the carrier power exceeded the sideband power by 6 to 8 decibels. With the proposed transitional scheme, high levels of modulation will inevitably produce significant audio distortion in conventional receivers, regardless of transmitter performance. Admittedly, the situation is somewhat different in HF broadcasting, where reception quality is often limited by propagation conditions, so imperfections in the detection process are of less consequence. However, it does mean that the audio processing, which is commonly used to enhance coverage of double sideband transmissions by boosting the average modulation index, might prove counterproductive in the single sideband case. It must also be remembered that some nations use HF for domestic services, where reception quality is likely to be of greater importance.
Thank you.
Continuing with the paper about implementing single sideband for broadcast transmission. Signal-to-noise ratio. While some degradation in reception quality may be acceptable, listeners to single sideband broadcasts equipped with conventional receivers will almost certainly experience a reduction in signal-to-noise ratio. This is more serious, as coverage is then likely to be affected. The precise reasons are explained by Groschel, but stem from the fact that an envelope detector gives effectively 3 dB more gain when excited by a double sideband signal compared with the result due to a single sideband signal. Consequently, to maintain the signal-to-noise ratio, it will be necessary to radiate a signal during the transitional period whose sideband power is twice the total sideband power of the present double sideband transmission. This results in an output power requirement beyond the capability of any given installation, if for no other reason than the limitation of the transmitter's HT power supply. Furthermore, in many cases, such high power would be required to realise this equivalence as to make the uprating of installations impractical. It must be remembered that 250, 300 and even 500 kilowatts units are now in general use. We have assumed here a 500 kilowatt double sideband transmitter, having an overall conversion efficiency of 65%, typical of the latest designs employing a switching modulator. It is also assumed that the conversion to single sideband would be achieved with no significant loss of efficiency, using some variant of the techniques described later. The accepted rating for such transmitters is likely to become the case where the sideband power equals the total sideband power of the present double sideband transmission, although that is still 3 dB below the optimum level. Given the above factors, it would seem that listeners using conventional receivers will almost certainly experience some degradation in service, although this would be of limited significance if dedicated single sideband receivers can be made widely available at a sufficiently low price. Suitable synthesizer-based receivers capable of phase locking to the residual carrier are being developed, but there must remain doubts as to whether such devices can ever be manufactured at a universally acceptable cost. Note that the simple single sideband demodulation techniques, as found in older communications receivers, while being suitable for basic voice detection, are inadequate for this application. Furthermore, governments wishing to prevent free access to external broadcasts must currently resort to such extremes as jamming, whereas controlling access to sophisticated receivers beyond the scope of local improvisation would seem relatively straightforward. Regardless of any other problems, the transition cannot proceed as planned unless suitable transmitters are available. Previous considerations of the conversion to single sideband have generally assumed that linear amplifiers or double sideband transmitters converted for linear operation would be employed. While such an approach might be feasible for the ultimate system when the radiated power is relatively low, the above arguments should have demonstrated why this is unlikely to prove a viable solution during the transitional period. The only transmitters capable of efficiently amplifying single sideband signals at high enough power are likely to be the latest designs employing a series switching modulator, such as the Marconi Advanced Pulsam system. The technique which has been developed to enable such transmitters to amplify single sideband signals will be first briefly described to emphasise the differences between this approach and the conventional linear amplification. It is felt that the characteristics of such systems need to be specifically taken into account before the SSB scheme is finalised to minimise future difficulties. The issue of test procedures, for example, is of particular concern, as is mentioned later. Results obtained from a Marconi B6126 300 kilowatt advanced Pulsam transmitter operating in its single sideband mode are presented to demonstrate the typical performance that can be expected from single sideband transmitters of this class. The pulse sound system was originated several years ago, when it was realised that if a switching mode of operation was employed in the high-level modulator of an HF transmitter, the overall efficiency could be significantly improved. The advanced pulse sound was subsequently evolved to meet the emerging requirements of variable carrier-level transmission and single sideband modulation. The high-level modulator is, in effect, a directly coupled high-efficiency audio amplifier capable of supplying the Class C RF output stage with a continuously variable HT supply. The operation of such a system as a single sideband amplifier relies on the fact that a single sideband signal can be resolved into equivalent phase and amplitude or envelope components. The constant amplitude phase components can be efficiently amplified through the Class C output stage, while the envelope component is amplified separately via the switching modulator. The signal radiated is the resultant when the two separate components are multiplied at the anode of the RF output valve, thus reconstituting the original single sideband signal at much higher power. This technique and its application to an advanced pulse sound transmitter was previously described at the International Broadcasting Convention 1986. The effectiveness of this approach, which is often referred to as envelope elimination and restoration, EER, is clearly illustrated by the results obtained from the actual transmitter when operating in this mode. In fact, this result is of additional interest since it corresponds to the equal tone test, which is widely used to characterise linear SSB amplifiers, and so is likely to be applied to transmitters employing the EER approach. This raises the whole issue of testing transmitters designed to radiate both double sideband and single sideband, which, for the reasons already given, are likely to be based on EER rather than conventional linear techniques. For example, the envelope corresponding to the equal tone test contains harmonics which are not present under conventional amplitude modulation. This places additional demands on the high-level modulation system, especially since a switching approach is necessary to give optimum efficiency. The problems concerned with implementing the EER technique on a transmitter of this type are more fully discussed in Reference 9, which is High Efficiency Transmission of Single Sideband Sound Broadcasting, an IBC 86 publication. However, under program conditions, this situation would be met only transiently, so it perhaps should not be the sole criterion by which to judge such a system. Nevertheless, it is important to identify the limitations of a transmitter using the EER approach. Any shortcomings in either of the separate amplification paths, such as inadequate frequency response through the modulator, inevitably prevent an accurate reconstruction of the single sideband signal at the output. This not only gives rise to audio distortion at the receiver, but also undesirable spurious emissions. It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright. You know I work all day to get your money to buy a thing, and it's worth it just to hear you say you're gonna give me everything. So why on earth should I moan? 'Cause when I get you alone, you know I feel okay. When I'm cold, everything seems to be right. When I'm cold, feeling you holding me tight, tight, yeah. It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright. So And continuing with single sideband HF transmitters, the paper from the International Broadcasting Convention by Marconi Communication Systems, presented by SD Pace and J.E. Brett. Conclusions. The successful transition to a single sideband modulation system will almost certainly depend on the continuing development of sophisticated transmission techniques, such as just described. However, the progress already achieved should not be underestimated. The results demonstrate a system delivering hundreds of kilowatts peak envelope power, far in excess of the capability of existing HF linear amplifiers, yet at an efficiency that until recently was not attainable in a conventional double-sideband transmitter. The single-sided spectrum recorded under program conditions is also perhaps the most convincing illustration of the inherent advantage of a single-sideband system. Nevertheless, as previously mentioned, the peculiarities and limitations of such systems need to be at least appreciated by both broadcasters and the international authorities. It must be remembered that within barely 2 years, given the existing WARC recommendations, all new transmitters might have to be capable of single sideband operation. The queries raised over the transitional arrangements were similarly intended to encourage continued discussions, perhaps leading to more extensive trials, rather than to emphasise any particular problem. Well, that's quite fascinating to see a paper presented on a subject which a lot of people who are actually involved in the technical side of broadcasting on HF are extremely sceptical about. The proposed transition to single sideband operation has received a lot of press coverage, and we don't really believe it will actually ever happen in our lifetimes. And so to Edifax and a million selling single.
Peter and Gordon, A World Without Love. Released in Britain on the Columbia record label in 1964, backed with If I Were You. This first million-selling single for the duo sold 550,000 copies in Britain and over 400,000 in the United States, as well as sales from other countries. The disc was number one for 2 weeks in Britain with 14 weeks in the best sellers. It first reached number one on the 25th of April, 1964. And it spent 1 week number one in the USA with 12 weeks in the American charts. It was released on the Capitol label in the States. Peter and Gordon were Peter Asher, born 22nd of June 1944 in London, and Gordon Waller, born 4th of June 1945 in Scotland. They first met at boarding school in 1959, and both had piano tuition. Peter also played guitar and double bass, and Gordon also played guitar. They began playing the guitar and singing together, performing at school concerts and eventually at local coffee bars. During a two-month booking at London's Pickwick Club, they were brought to the attention of EMI Records, who sent a representative man round to hear them. The next day, they were summoned to EMI to record one of their own songs, If I Were You. But a strong number was needed for the reverse side of the disc. The duo then remembered that the Beatles, John Lennon and Paul McCartney, had written a song for them which was not yet completed, A World Without Love. When finished, it turned out to be a big hit for all concerned. The duo then did radio, TV and personal appearances in Britain. Peter also appeared in such TV productions as Robin Hood and Sword of Freedom. They also went to the USA in 1964 and did a long tour, becoming extremely popular there. Asher later became a prominent producer in the USA.
Please lock me away and don't allow stay in a world without love. Birds sing out a tune, and rain clouds hide the moon. I'm okay, here I'll stay with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love. True love smile, she may come, I know not when. When she does, I lose. So baby, until then, lock me away and don't allow the day here inside where I hide with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love.
Is Radio Facts 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
With Trevor Brooke
and Maggie Stevenson. And now a piece by John Horgan in The Guardian. John Horgan in Dublin on why IRA is in a hurry for new broadcasting services. The Irish government have appointed an independent-minded member of the Supreme Court, Mr. Justice Henchy, to act as chairman of its new radio and television authority. The authority has been given the task of establishing a new commercial radio channel by spring 1989 and a new television channel by autumn of next year, in addition to the early creation of a network of local radio stations. 24 hours after its first meeting, in an indication of the sense of urgency with which the authority views its task, four-page advertisements appeared in all national newspapers inviting those interested parties in the new franchise to apply without delay. Many of the remaining members of the authority have associations with the ruling Fianna Fáil party. This has not caused as much controversy, however, as two aspects of the Radio and Television Act 1988, under which they will operate. The first is that while the authority may propose, the Minister for Communications, Mr. Ray Burke, still disposes. He has to retain the power to issue the actual broadcasting licences. He may also unilaterally vary the terms of contracts the authority issues. Second, the Act provides that no details will be given of applicants for broadcasting licences other than, in due course, details of the successful applicants. The speed with which the authority has been asked to undertake this task relates not only to the project for the new services having been so long in gestation, but to the continuing embarrassment caused by the proliferation of pirate radio stations, of which some 70 now exist. They have been warned that if they are on the air after this year, they will feel the full rigour of the law. A number of potentially lucrative franchises in both radio and television, replacing the public service broadcasting monopoly model, which is operated under Radio RTE, will be awarded in the coming months after years of controversy about privatising the airwaves came to an end with the two new acts. RTE will, of course, remain and is fighting back with the innovatory long-wave radio station, planned jointly with Radio Luxembourg, which will target the UK mass market. Both the Republicans' major parties have for years been urging the introduction of commercial local radio.
Between 1983 and 1987, however, the coalition was prevented by its Labour partner from proceeding with a bill to end RTE's monopoly. The authority to be created under the new legislation will be autonomous in the exercise of its powers. It will also be very slimline. It will own no transmitting equipment and will be financed by an initial government grant of up to £1 million. Thereafter, its income will come from fees, and most notably, a levy on advertising revenue, which it may fix, but which is generally expected to be 5%. The new legislation, in fact, goes considerably further than originally envisaged in many respects. The problems created by pirate radio stations, some 70 exist in the Republic, some of them extremely profitable, was compounded by the absence of adequate legislation to shut them down. The government, aware of the squatters' rights these stations had established with the listening public, felt it could not strengthen the anti-pirate laws without providing a legitimate alternative. This tidying up process, however, became subsumed in a larger project, the creation not only of a network of local town and neighbourhood stations, the distinctions are still unclear, but of two new commercial national channels, one radio and the other television. The new authority is expected to be in place within a matter of a few weeks. The franchises for the smaller radio stations should enable some of them to become operational before the end of the year. Newspapers, the Republic has 5 morning dailies, 3 evenings and 4 Sunday newspapers, catering for its 3.5 million population, will be allowed to apply for radio or television franchises. A number of critical obligations have been written into the new legislation, notably for the new television channel. The franchise holders, who of course need not necessarily be Irish, will be obliged to carry a reasonable proportion of Irish as well as European community-produced programming and of independently-produced programming. All the new services will be required to devote not less than 20% of broadcasting time to news and current affairs. As these will not receive licence fee monies, they will be allowed to allocate up to 15% of broadcasting time to advertising. They will all be subject to the same restrictions as RTE on broadcasting interviews with a spokesman for Sinn Féin, the IRA, or other paramilitary groupings. RTE, which is particularly subvented by the licence fee, currently 62 Irish punts for a colour receiver, is restricted to a 10% advertising ratio and views the new developments with some apprehension. It anticipates that it could easily lose up to £2 million annually in advertising revenue and is embarked on a voluntary staff reduction programme. Its most innovative step, however, has been its partnership with Radio Luxembourg in the new Radio Tara, which, in addition to providing the Republic with its first national longwave station, will have access to a large part of the UK. If Radio Tara gets on the air after overcoming programming objections, it will provide a popular music programme throughout the day aimed primarily at the 15 to 35-year age bracket. Such is the interest from the UK that RTE has already rejected lucrative offers from a number of UK companies for its share of the joint company. This commercial missionary zeal is being complemented by a new sense of urgency about helping national reception of multiple television channels. The East Coast of the Republic has been able to pick up some British television signals for some 30 years, and most urban areas now have some kind of multi-channel reception. But the government's latest plan envisages a dramatic increase in the choices available. The only development which has so far been stalled is DBS, because of what Ray Burke describes as the very significant costs involved. At the same time, however, the government is exploring the possibility of getting DBS interests in both Ireland and Britain to work together on the project.
And from the Irish press, pirates, in inverted commas, to face jail, Burke. A nationwide advertising campaign is to be launched by Communications Minister Ray Burke, warning pirate radio operators that they face prison under new laws which are aimed at clearing the airwaves for licensed independent radio. The pirates and advertisers on their stations face £20,000 penalties or 3 months imprisonment on conviction on indictment if they continue to broadcast after December the 31st. Announcers, producers and suppliers also face similar penalties. A spokesman for the Department of Communications said that the minister wanted all those interested to know that he intended to use the full rigours of the law to sink the pirates. Meanwhile, Mr. Burke formally launched the Independent Radio and Television Commission in Dublin. He said he hoped the commission would ensure that a, quote, reasonable amount of legal stations were broadcasting early in the new year. There should be the minimum possible hiatus between the close down of the illegal stations and the coming on stream of the new stations, he said. The commission, under the chairmanship of Mr. Seamus Henchy, is empowered to hand out franchises for the new National Independent Radio Network, an independent television station, and a series of local town and neighbourhood radio stations. Mr. Burke wants fast progress in establishing these new services. They will require substantial investment, and the viability of proposals is likely to be very complex, the minister said. The commission should look at the character, expertise, financial soundness, and the quality of programming being planned by each applicant, the minister said. The national radio station should be on the air by spring, and the minister has set an autumn deadline for the television station. That from the Irish Times. And that article is interesting for what it does not mention, which is that if you are not convicted on indictment but convicted on summary conviction by the local magistrates, the maximum fine in the Act is only 1,000 Irish punts.
Words list suggested for television code of practice. This is a report by Sally Tyne, the media correspondent of the Daily Telegraph. A list of words and actions which may not be shown on television has been suggested by the Broadcasting Standards Council, currently compiling a code of practice relating to sex and violence. The suggestion is made in a 5-page consultation document recently sent to broadcasters and pressure groups. Their responses will be collated shortly. Alternatively, the Council says that enunciating general principles and matters to be treated with care may be sufficient. The Council's code, to be decided in agreement with the BBC and IBA, will be enacted in 1989 and will apply to all television and radio broadcasts. The document discloses that the Council is also contemplating displaying warning symbols on the screen, such as the red triangle once used by Channel 4 and the British Board of Film Censors rating. New categories of material considered offensive, together with racist language, bad treatment of women, the depiction of crime and criminals, and drug taking, may also be introduced under the code. The document asks if there should be a single code of practice applying to cable, satellite, and terrestrial services, or whether, because these services are obtained by various methods, different regulations may be required. The Council's ruling on this point is keenly awaited by both British Satellite Broadcasting and Sky Television subscription services to be launched next year. They would like to screen uncut films which terrestrial broadcasters are not allowed to show, but Lord Rees-Mogg, Chairman of the Council, has given no clear indication as to whether the same code will be applied. Mrs. Mary Whitehouse, Chairman of the National Viewers and Listeners Association, said that the existing code of practice operated by the BBC and ITV were very enlightened, but the problem has been with the failure of producers to implement them and the failure of the broadcasting authorities to ensure that they do so. The Broadcasting Standards Council was set up in May by the Home Secretary. Broadcast codes on the advertising of alcohol are still being flouted in an attempt to appeal to the young and to promote a macho image for drinkers, according to Baroness Masham, head of the Home Office Working Group on Alcohol. Lady Masham has also challenged the claims of advertisers that there was no link between drink consumption and advertising. She said at a seminar organised by Action on Alcohol Abuse, "Even though stricter guidelines for advertisers have been introduced, they have not stuck to them. You can still find quite horrific advertising, giving a macho or glamorous image which attracts the young who think that if they see it on television, it must be all right."
And in The Independent, IBA stops Crown's £5.6 million Radio Mercury merger. Shares in Crown Communications plunged as the television and radio company revealed that the Independent Broadcasting Authority had scotched its planned merger with unquoted Radio Mercury. Christopher Chataway, chairman of Crown, said, "It is certainly an odd decision. It seems quite inconsistent with the government's deregulation plans." The IBA said the merger would have created a broadcaster with too dominant a market position in independent local radio. It would have had a potential audience of 9.5 million listeners. Crown already owns LBC, the London station. Mercury transmits in the Surrey-Sussex borders. Unlisted securities market quoted Crown, which already owns 18.3% of Mercury, announced the agreed takeover on the 5th of October, pending approval from the IBA. According to Crown, the IBA decision conflicts with the government stance, which is that companies should be allowed to own up to 6 local stations. Crown owns only LBC. However, it has substantial minority stakes in 16 other commercial stations, the result of its merger with Chalford Communications. Crown will now support plans for a management buyout at Mercury. Other large shareholders include Richard Branson's Virgin Group and George Walker's Brent Walker. Under the original terms, Crown was offering 11 of its shares for every 2 Mercury, or 900 pence in cash. It had received conditional acceptances from 34.9% of the Radio Mercury shareholders.
Shoes are made of leather, but I'm a substitute for another guy. I look
Is Radio Fax 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. And now a piece by Greg Dyke, who is Director of Programmes of London Weekend Television, which appeared in The Independent recently. As the government finalises its plans for the future of British television, a myth is taking hold. It is feared that ITV, facing competition from satellite and cable channels, will turn to wall-to-wall game shows and American cop shows to boost ratings, forcing BBC One to do the same. What we have known as British popular television will then disappear. These critics point to France, where newly privatised TF1 has used Dallas and game shows to become the number one channel. But they misunderstand the British viewer. Very few US imports do well on British television. To turn in this direction would spell disaster for ITV. In the past, when ITV revenue suddenly stopped growing, it cut popular drama production and used game shows, US material and repeats instead. The result was a slump in audiences, especially in the South. ITV is only now pulling out of the latest dip, largely because of spending on popular dramas such as The Bill or London's Burning. The problem is that ITV is inevitably going to change. By the mid-1990s, it is likely there will be less money for original programming. Government is determined to increase the price of a franchise. There will be competition for advertising revenue for the first time from Channel 5 and the satellites. Competition will force up the price of films and successful United States series. So where can ITV cut back? First, it must continue to reduce labour costs, but efficiency savings are unlikely to be enough. Cuts in regional news and current affairs are possible, but may not be wise. there are many days when the highest rated ITV show in London is a news bulletin. A strong national news programme is important to ITV's future. As a future defence, ITV will need to spend proportionately more on British popular drama and popular entertainment. The satellites won't have the money to make it. The BBC will, and it's important for ITV to pull audiences from the BBC while the news services attack us both. So it's inevitable that reductions will come in the areas of minority programming or where ITV does not perform well. In the new world, should it be ITV's responsibility to spend £7 million a year on schools programmes or £3 million on adult education, 2 hours of religion on Sunday at a cost of £6.7 million, £13 million on current affairs, £21.5 million on documentaries, £44 million on children's programming? It seems heresy to ask these questions, but they will probably have to be asked, and the likely answer is that these programmes cannot all be retained at their existing level. Reducing spending on quality popular programming to preserve the existing level of minority programming would itself lead to a drop in ITV's share of audience and, in turn, a drop in its advertising revenue. There would then be a need for further cuts in all areas of programming, including minority programming. If the battle for quality popular programming is lost, then much more will be lost. Here, the relationship between ITV and Channel 4 is all important. If that continues unchanged, then minority programming will still flourish in the independent system, albeit increasingly on Channel 4. To those who claim this logic means ITV will eventually end up delivering pap to the viewers, I point to a recent Sunday night where the ITV schedule was "It'll Be All Right on the Night," "Piece of Cake," "Hale and Pace," and "The South Bank Show." They all happened to be LWT shows. In London, that lineup achieved a 63% share of the BBC ITV audience. The first three shows were unashamedly popular, but none could conceivably be described as pap. The future strength of ITV depends on our ability to produce popular quality programmes of this type. Those of us looking to the future are accused of rushing to abandon ITV's current remit before the competition strikes. This is not the case. British industry is littered with the graves of those who failed to see what was coming and plan early enough. ITV needs to use its healthy profits now to invest in the future, to develop more popular quality programming. The Murdoch channels will be on stream next February, British Satellite Broadcasting next autumn, and Channel 5 by 1993. ITV's advertising monopoly is about to be broken. The future is almost here. Well, that was a piece by Greg Dyke, who is Director of Programmes for London Weekend Television, as it appeared in The Independent recently.
Are you interested in improving AM reception? We are now producing a PhaseLock AM synchronous detector unit. There are four controls on the front panel. Loop, wide, medium or narrow, allows use with unstable signals or transmitters carrying phase-modulated radio data. Next, a selector provides low distortion envelope detection, double sideband, lower sideband, upper sideband, independent sideband or stereo spread, giving intriguing effects with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, and quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and allows audio from any weaker co-channel station to be heard more clearly. The remaining two controls are centre frequency and window on-off, which enables the unit to hold lock tenaciously, even under severe interference or complete fade-out. Apart from the well-known benefit of reducing the gross distortion of selective fading, synchronous detection also provides an improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. The remaining objectionable effect during a selective fade is the surging in audio level, as the receiver AGC unnecessarily increases the gain. So our unit also includes a broadcast quality multiple time constant audio limiter. The complete boxed unit costs £150, and a detailed information sheet is available if you send along one 14 pence British stamp or one international reply coupon to Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
From the Financial Times, Sinclair announces cheap receiver for satellite television by Raymond Snoddy. Sir Clive Sinclair, the consumer electronics innovator, is entering the satellite television receiver market more than 4 years after he first promised to produce inexpensive equipment. Sir Clive has designed a flat square receiver measuring 60 centimetres across, capable of receiving at least 14 channels from the Astra satellite due to be launched in December. Sir Clive said yesterday that the receiving equipment would be available early next year at a price considerably lower than anything else on offer so far. A basic unit, including the receiver and tuning unit, would be available at £149.95, with a remote control version costing £179.95. A top-of-the-range model, including stereo reception, would be available at £229.95. The receiver has been produced by Sir Clive's company, Cambridge Computer. It will probably be manufactured by SCI, the Scottish company that manufactures his Z88 personal computer. The equipment is due to be launched in mid-December and will be able to receive Mr. Rupert Murdoch's 4 planned satellite channels. It was in February 1984 that Sir Clive announced to a deeply sceptical world that he believed he would be able to make receiving equipment for the then BBC Direct Broadcasting by satellite venture. Instead, Sir Clive has chosen to produce receiving equipment for the Astra satellite rather than the high-powered DBS market, now represented by British Satellite Broadcasting.
Radio 4 seeks to cure writer's cramp by Richard North in The Independent. The BBC has discovered that too few listeners to Radio 4 can write, After 34 years of allowing radiophiles a weekly written assault on the four opinionates employed to row with each other after a hotel dinner on any questions, the corporation has decided that any answers, the write-in which used to follow it after a decent postal interlude, should be taken off the air. It will be replaced by a live phone-in. The audience for any questions has fallen to 2 million from its peak of 16 million 30 years ago. It contains fewer and fewer people who will put pen to paper. In recent years, any answers was based on less than 100 letters, Michael Green, Radio 4's controller, said. The BBC is believed to feel too many of the trickle of letters to any answers came from people of the same social class. Indeed, many were from the same people, who will now be deprived of the excitement of having their effusions read out once a year. Mr. Green said that people were nowadays too busy to write letters. They have also been too busy to listen to any answers, whose time has been cut from 30 to 10 minutes in recent years. They will now have to find 30 minutes for a phone-in. Starting in the new year, this will be hosted by Jonathan Dimbleby, who is being relied on to rescue the channel's ailing reputation for emptying the football terraces of a Saturday afternoon. The new programme is designed to remove the main obstacles to debate amongst its new audience. The young will not be hindered by their illiteracy unless it runs so deep they cannot dial, and the new Any Answers will happen so quickly after the weekend repeat of Any Questions that their short attention span will not be a bar to their exercise of free speech either. In the old days, an interval between the two shows was required to allow tempers to cool. Nowadays, in homogeneous Britain, the gap must be as short as possible because no one can for long remember what the argument was all about.
And troubled news from Greece, as reported in the Daily Telegraph. Radio and television newscasters and journalists in Greece went on strike after revelations that broadcasters were compelled to read prepared texts praising the Prime Minister, Mr. Andreas Papandreou, and his girlfriend. The strike, supported by the Athens Union of Journalists, followed weekend events when the government took measures to stage a popular welcoming demonstration for Mr. Papandreou. The 69-year-old premier had returned with his mistress, Mrs. Dimitra Liani, 34, after 2 months in London, where he underwent open-heart surgery. Journalists working for the state-controlled networks said they were presented with texts on his homecoming, complete with descriptions of enthusiastic crowds, which were written by officials before he had arrived. A government spokesman angered the journalists' union further by saying that the broadcasters were free to leave if they didn't like their work. The union reacted by calling a 24-hour strike. As a result, except for broadcasts by local private radio stations, no news will be heard in Greece, and light entertainment is therefore being substituted.
11 apply for cordless phone licences. 11 groups have applied to the Department of Trade and Industry to operate Britain's proposed digital cordless telephone services known as Telepoint. The DTI has said it will grant between 2 and 4 licences. Applicants include British Telecom with STC and 9X of the United States, Ferranti, Marconi, Mercury, Plessy, Raycal, Shea Communications with Motorola, Philips, and the United States company Millicom.
Gone. to you. At night I see my questions, I feel my doubts, wishing that maybe in a year or two we could laugh and let it all out. Now that you've made yourself love me, do you think I can change it in a day? How can I place you above me? Am I lying to you when I say that I believe in you?
In all the Irish press, a full-page advertisement, Independent Radio and Television Commission. On the 17th of October 1988, Mr. Ray Burke, TD, Minister for Communications, established the Independent Radio and Television Commission. The brief of the commission is to arrange for the provision of sound broadcasting services, including a national sound broadcasting service and one television service, additional to any broadcasting services currently provided by Radio Telefish Éireann. If you wish to comment on the activities of the commission or have suggestions to offer on how it should conduct its affairs, please contact the address below. And then there are three separate services advertised.
Firstly, the Independent National Radio Service. It says the Commission hereby invites written submissions from persons or bodies interested in the provision of a national independent radio service. The submissions should indicate, in general terms, the type of service which would be provided. Submissions should reach the Commission before the 1st of November 1988 and be accompanied by a fee of £500. The Commission will require the completion of a detailed application before the 16th of December 1988. Application documentation will be forwarded to each person or body who makes a submission as above. The Commission draws the attention of applicants to the criteria laid down in the Radio and Television Act 1988, which it will use in considering applications, and to the duties that will be imposed on the successful applicant under the various provisions of the Act. Please address all correspondence to the address below.
And secondly, an independent television programme service. The Commission hereby invites applications from persons or bodies interested in securing a contract for the provision of an independent television broadcast service, which will be distributed using channel capacity on cable and television retransmission systems, multipoint microwave distribution systems.
And finally, but not least, a local sound broadcasting service. The interested party should provide an application of his or her capacity to provide the service in question, the general approach which would be taken to the provision of the service, the type of service that would be proposed, and the service area of interest. In this regard, attention is drawn to the criteria laid down in Section 6.2 of the Act that are to be used by the Commission when it comes to invite and consider applications for contracts, and to the duties that will be imposed on successful applicants under the various provisions of the Act.
And the address for the Independent Commission is Scotch House, Hawkins Street, Dublin 2. And that's the same address as the Department of Communications, which regulates the wireless telegraphy laws in Ireland. European Community Competition Law May Halt Television Venture by Raymond Snoddy in the Financial Times. Mr. Rupert Murdoch's Sky Television and the European Broadcasting Union countries have been warned that their planned satellite joint venture, Eurosport, may be in breach of the Treaty of Rome. Under the plan, the BBC and about a dozen other EBU members have decided to launch the channel on the Astra satellite. The broadcasters would contribute their rights to European sporting events, and Sky Television, which would have a 51% stake, would fund the high-cost venture. Both sides have been informed from a high level in the European Commission that there are strong reservations about the venture on grounds of competition policy. WH Smith, the British retail and satellite television company, already has a sports television channel, Screen Sport, and has made a formal complaint to the Commission that it is being denied access to rights to broadcast important European sporting events. Commission officials have decided that there is a prima facie case against the Eurosport plan, and work has begun on drawing up a formal declaration to present to the European commissioners. If the commissioners agree, Eurosport investors could be taken to the European court. Commission opposition might lead to the venture's collapse. The BBC, for example, is very keen to go ahead with Eurosport, but is equally unlikely to proceed in the face of a formal Commission declaration that the venture is against community competition law. Mr. Jim Stiles, managing director of Sky Television, said last night he had not been informed about Commission opposition to the Eurosport venture. Whatever happened in Brussels, a satellite sports channel would be launched.
And a letter that appeared on the pages of the Independent newspaper from Philip Bacon, who is chairman of the Radio Academy. Government ban on broadcasting. How ironic that the radio industry's professional body should meet for its AGM on the very day that the Home Secretary orders his restrictive measures over broadcasts by supporters of Sinn Féin and the Ulster Defence Association. Members of the Radio Academy, which represents 700 radio practitioners, reacted with the deepest dismay to this. While recognising the need to combat terrorism, they felt that this move would prove to be largely unworkable and saw it as a direct challenge to broadcasters' efforts to provide information and a platform for a full exchange of views. One effect is to ban us from broadcasting the words of Gerry Adams, an elected member of Parliament, unless he chooses to say them in the Commons or during an election. Yet we may report his words as long as we do not use his voice. If the government's aim is to starve such a man of publicity, what is the logic in not prescribing reports of any kind? The answer must be that newspapers would then be affected too, and there has always been a curious reluctance to apply equally restrictive measures to them. Radio and television broadcasts, it is argued, have far more impact than the printed word. Again, ironically, a tribute to the power of the microphone. It is time the government realised that broadcasters have more professional standards and are not bent on undermining society. A little more thought and discussion before such measures are adopted might save the government the kind of embarrassment the Skycatcher case caused it. The Radio Academy is a forum the Home Secretary knows well, having spoken twice at our annual radio festival. Yet he did not choose to consult us, the BBC, or the Independent Broadcasting Authority. Perhaps now the government will reflect and decide to enter into some dialogue on this very serious curtailment of our great tradition of free speech. That was a letter that was published in The Independent recently, and it was written by Mr. Philip Bacon, who is chairman of the Radio Academy.
May you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. May you never make your bed out. If you get hit in a marrow fight, may you never lose your woman overnight. Well, you're just like a great strong sister to me, and I know that you love me. me in my back. I know that the sun will do. So please, won't you please, won't you bury tonight? Love is a lesson to learn in our time. Please, won't you please, bury tonight for me. And may you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. And you just never make your bed out in the cold. May you never lose your temper if you get hit in a barroom fight. Like a great strong brother to me, and I know that your love is true. And you never talk dirty behind my back. I know that the sun never do. So please, won't you please, won't you bury the mind? Love is a lesson to learn in a hard time. Please, won't you please, bury the mind for me. May you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. You never make your bed out in the cold. May you never lose your temper if you get it in a barroom fight. May you never lose your woman overnight. May you never lose your
broadcasting white paper has been agreed by the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister has given her agreement to the final form of the forthcoming white paper on broadcasting, which will fundamentally alter the framework of ITV, reducing its public service obligations and encouraging the development of subscription television alongside advertising-funded satellite services. The much-leaked draft was vetted by a group of ministers, including Douglas Hurd, the Home Secretary, Lord Young, the Secretary of State for Industry, Kenneth Baker, the Secretary of State for Education, Sir Geoffrey Howe, the Foreign Secretary, and Norman Lamont, Financial Secretary to the Treasury. It will go to a meeting of the Cabinet next week for final approval. Publication is expected sometime during November. The White Paper will confirm the Special Minority Interest Quality Programming remit of Channel 4, but it is expected to leave open for debate how it is to be financed and owned. The White Paper will aim to set up an enabling framework for a development of a multi-channel future, rather than dictating a rigid framework and picking winners. It also emphasises the continued provision of a comprehensive, high-quality ITV news service from ITN or its equivalent. The government is anxious not to hand the BBC a monopoly in this area. The White Paper will set out the basis for the creation of a commercial television authority, replacing the Independent Broadcasting Authority, to set the detailed rules by which ITV franchises will be renewed and other forms of commercial television regulated. The auctioning process will be through a controlled form of tender, tempered with provisions to safeguard programme quality for the next 8-year period from 1st January 1993. Companies will bid for access to a broadcast frequency and the right to sell advertising over a geographical area. The White Paper will also give the Broadcasting Standard Council a statutory responsibility to monitor sexual and violent programme content and will withdraw the television's exemption from the Obscene Publications Act.
London weekend television profits slide 31% after job cuts by Patrick Hosking, business reporter of The Independent. Profits before tax at LWT Holdings slumped 31% to £15.8 million as the London weekend television contractor unveiled a £7.3 million exceptional item, depressing its results for the year to the 31st of July. LWT shares dipped 5 pence to 172p as the company announced that the net cost of its radical plan to scrap 300 jobs was £6.5 million, more than expected. Even ignoring that exceptional item, pre-tax profits edged only a disappointing 3% higher. Christopher Bland, chairman, blamed the increased Channel 4 subscription and Independent Broadcasting Authority rental, together up 23.6% to £6.3 million. The cancellation of Betty, a musical starring Twiggy, which was scuppered by an industrial dispute, cost almost £1 million. LWT's market share of advertising revenue fell fractionally too. There was an extraordinary item of £2.2 million, with the £5.2 million net cost of the investment in the pan-European satellite station Super Channel, partly offset by a £3.3 million profit from the sale of travel subsidiary Page & Moy to Barclays Bank. Mr. Bland said he would reduce or sell LWT's 25% stake in Century Hutchinson, the publisher, when it was floated in late 1989 or 1990. This would fetch considerably more than its £2.5 million book value. Earnings per share before exceptional items were unchanged at 15.8 pence. Mr. Bland said the current year had begun well, although the economic background was more uncertain than a year ago. Next month, the government is due to announce how it plans to modify the way the Exchequer levy on television companies is calculated.
European television challenges the business journals, a report by Andrew Lycett of The Times. Europe's middle managers could soon be getting their daily financial information from a satellite television rather than from the Financial Times or the International Herald Tribune. At least, that is the intention of a clutch of leading economics reporters who have defected from British television to the new European Business Channel, known as EBC. Will Hutton, former economics correspondent for BBC Television's Newsnight, is editor-in-chief of EBC, whose first half-hour programme goes out next week in English and German on European cable networks, largely via the Sky satellite. Hutton works in high-tech offices in the suburbs of Zurich, close to the international airport. Appearing on screen in the English version are James Long and Ed Mitchell, formerly economics correspondents of the BBC and ITN respectively. In a journalistic team of 32, 10 of whom are English, they have equally impressive German counterparts. EBC is the brainchild of a 49-year-old Swiss media entrepreneur, James Winnersdorfer, who spied a gap in the market for pan-European financial and business information. He secured blue-chip Swiss backing and hired a former chairman of the Swiss National Broadcasting Corporation as its head. It's as if he had recruited Duke Hussey and raised money from the FT and News International, says Hutton, who has a programme budget of 17.95 million Swiss francs, or about £7 million a year. He can afford to have four electronics news gathering, ENG, teams continually on call. The typical EBC programme is divided into two parts, what Hutton characterises as the front page of the Wall Street Journal, a lead story which is as likely to be political as economic, international headlines, a film report, and a review of the European papers. Then, after the advertisements, the Financial World Tonight, a business section with live satellite leads from world stock markets and business centres, together with company profiles. Current film schedule is full of heavyweight names, including the French finance minister and the German Social Democrat leader. And who will watch this strange hybrid? Hutton sees his audience as young to middle-aged who work in any kind of environment that is international. They will have to be up early to see it, though, 5:30 a.m. in Britain and 6:30 a.m. on the continent. Subsequently, later editions will be transmitted. He believes key political and economic decisions affecting Britain will increasingly be taken in Europe. Not surprisingly, Euro politicians like Balladur and Vogel have cooperated willingly, their British equivalents rather less so. It will end up as a great non-event, predicts Michael Brehm, chairman of Broadcast Communications, the public company which produces Business Daily at lunchtime and the Business Programme every week for Channel 4. I'm sceptical that there is a demand for a European-wide information service. If they were talking about a weekly programme of this type, it might work. But the average person going to the office simply wants the business agenda for the day in his own market. The demand is for national programmes, for national audiences. But Mr. Hutton counters that such thinking is not only anachronistic, but in business terms it's dangerous. Over the next 5 years, people like us will grow because we're advertisement financed. If they're successful, European production houses, such as EBC, will be able to spend more, while Business Daily's production expenditure is tied to contractual fees from Channel 4. Hutton says it's significant in this context that another continental business programme, the Euro Business Weekly, fronted by another former BBC man, Peter Hobday, on Super Channel, goes out from Hilversum in the Netherlands rather than London. Such undisguised rivalry suggests that a European business programme could certainly succeed. Certainly, Business Daily is moving up quickly next Easter to take on an additional breakfast slot. Hutton also suggests that Brehm is worried that broadcast communication, like diverse reports before it, will lose its exclusive contract arrangement with Channel 4 as the latter begins to take material from EBC. Certainly, EBC is keen to extend its range beyond the half-hour magazine format. It already intends to provide film reports for Rupert Murdoch's new Sky TV news channel. And an unknown factor is how the BBC's new financial unit under Daniel Jeffries, recruited last year directly from the City, will react. Advertisers remain to be convinced of EBC's potential. Judy Thomas, International Media Director of Darcy Macy's Benton & Bowles, says since there is a market for pan-European business publications, she doesn't see why a business channel should not succeed. She believes it could draw adverts from financial service companies, hotel groups, computer houses and luxury goods manufacturers. But she says EBC will have to be very clear what it's doing and will have to have very deep pockets because this is extremely difficult and costly to do well. But Richard Dan, International Media Director of Collett Dickinson Pierce, believes city people will be better able to get what they want early in the morning from print rather than by visual media.
Radio Facts will finish in December. We have been on the air for 3 months, and through that time you have been sending us over 100 letters each week telling us how much this kind of speech programming is appreciated. We also know that we have a fair number of very enthusiastic blind listeners. So, we remain a legal operation and close down in December, unless some government writes us out the licence we have been asking for since 3 years ago. What would the other possible options be? We could stay on the air from the Republic of Ireland, or we could come on the air from England. By making public the time and place, this would be a fairly straightforward act of civil disobedience, and the presumably inevitable court case would form part of the history of broadcasting. If hundreds of you write to say that is what you think we should do, then I suppose we would have to consider it seriously. But we have to make it clear now that these are not options we regard as compatible with a professional operation.
The letters you send are what has made this project worthwhile, and thank again to everyone who has taken the trouble to write. We get letters from people aged 17 to 70, and anyone in the media world will know that something appealing to such an age range is most unusual. Some of the historical items we've carried are the development of magnetic tape, the story of radar, old BBC transmitting stations, the inventions of magnetic recording, from wire recorders to digital tape, and others have brought in letters from people involved in the work up to 50 years ago. If we were staying on the air, one thing we would have liked to do was organise a contact point so that people who worked together years ago could get in touch with each other again.
One thing we have achieved might be the most listened to programme per watt transmitted. And we mean listened to, Many shortwave stations are heard and logged, but your letters make it clear that people do listen to radio facts.
The use of shortwaves has fallen significantly over the last 20 years, and everyone seems agreed that with a view to the future, what radio facts has demonstrated is now a useful and appropriate use of 9 kHz of the spectrum. What can you do? Well, if you think radio facts or something like it should be offered a licence, you could write to your Member of Parliament at the House of Commons, London SW1A OAA.
And now to your letters. Thank you to Aslak Hakadal from Vennesla in Norway for your letter, and from Liverpool. I have only just started shortwave listening and was very surprised when I tuned into 6205 as I found your format very interesting. Keep up the good work, says A.L. Boston from Liverpool.
A letter from Belgium here, 50 miles from Brussels, in a town which I'll try and pronounce. I think it's Grimbergen, from Jos Blondiel. Thank you very much for your letter.
And thank you for the ballpoint pen to Jari Parkinen from Seinäjoki in Finland.
Jim Solati wrote to us from Finland with postcard and said thank you for your interesting programmes, especially news about radio stations all around the world.
Thank you for your letter, A. Rose, from Coolboki by Dingwall in Highland, Scotland. An interesting broadcast, says K.D. Palmer from Odeby in Leicester, England.
And a letter from Hartmannsdorf in East Germany, not West Germany, but East Germany, from a Mr. Manfred Bridau. Thank you for your letter. He says, I hear that you are fighting to be a legal station in the United Kingdom. Please write me what is the actual position of you and your government. Well, I think we have made that sort of fairly clear over the weeks, but he goes on to say the programme is very interesting for him.
And thank you, Jorgen Borrison from Greenlands, Redditch, Worcestershire, for your letter. And from Clevedon, Avon, Jim Blakely writes, I came across your programme quite by chance while twiddling the dial of my receiver. Although mainly interested in radio, I am mildly interested in the world of television and hi-fi recording, and found your programme most interesting and will look out for more.